knockoff designer goods are notorious for not fooling anybody. If you come across somebody selling Air Gordons out of the trunk of his car, not only is the name wrong, but the materials and the workmanship probably look shoddy even at a glance. But what if somebody used the same high-quality leather, the same rubber treads, the same quality control in assembling these shoes, and then offered them to you for like $100? That makes these fakes cost more than the Air Gordons, but they are indistinguishable from the real sneakers that can retail for more than $1,000. And now you've entered the realm of the super fake. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Amy X. Wang is assistant managing editor of the New York Times Magazine. Her obsession with exquisitely fabrications of genuine designer goods started with her lust for a particular handbag known as the Celine Triomphe. For those unfamiliar, this is a rectangular leather purse with a distinctive gold buckle that measures maybe a little bigger than your cell phone and currently retails for somewhere around $2,200. I know. But the heart wants what it wants, and Amy X. Wang wanted one of these so badly that when she heard she could have an essentially identical bag for vastly less, provided she was willing to risk prison time for carrying it around on her trip to Paris, she went for it. She writes about this in a recent article for the Times Magazine called Inside the Delirious Rise of Super Fake Handbags. Amy, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a fascinating piece, not least because you interrogate what it is that makes any of us, wealthy or not, crave a luxury version of some essentially basic item. I mean, any one of us could carry our things around in a plastic grocery bag, but we don't. We want something nicer. So whether or not we've ever wanted a true designer item, almost nobody's immune to the desire for something that we think is beautiful.
You know, that is exactly what's fascinated me about the piece and the response to it. I have actually gotten a lot of notes from male readers who don't know anything about purses, but are like, I totally understand this feeling, like whether they, because they've been obsessed with a watch or a particular item of clothing or whatever else. So it does strike me as something that is incredibly universal, and it's not even necessarily something specific to women and handbags, but rather to human beings and our obsession with things in the first place.
And this bag that you coveted, the Celine Triomphe, is unquestionably a beautiful object. Will you describe it for us?
Sure. It is basically, if you imagine just a purse in your head, you'd imagine probably something of a rectangle shape that can just practically hold like a wallet and a phone. And that basically is this bag, just with a buckle on it. So it's like a plain handbag with a sort of Celine logo buckle on it. And the price of it is not, you know, $50 as you would expect from your average purse that you can pick up at Target, but rather like $2,200 just for that buckle, which is sort of hilarious to think about.
Yeah, when you looked it up online, the real thing, you realized this was, I'm guessing, way out of your budget, right, as a journalist, and kind of a severe deviation from the way you were raised to think about and to spend money.
Yeah, I personally grew up in Beijing, China, and in various parts of the U.S. From an immigrant family that had the perspective of, you know, like we spend money in order to live and to have shelter and food on the table and not to be frivolous. So an expensive designer handbag kind of seemed to me like it was the epitome of frivolity when it came down to it. Like there's no reason I would need to spend this money just to hold my stuff in a bag. So it felt like this like incredibly like self-gratuitous journey it to go down, even exploring the idea of buying a real designer bag. But when I did find the idea of super fakes, which were incredibly realistic, hyper-realistic bags for a fraction of the cost-benefit analysis starts to even out a little bit more, right? Because you're like, wait a minute, if I can spend $100 to get this beautiful thing, maybe it's not so frivolous.
So how did you find your way to this group of people who had found this kind of loophole of super fakes so that they didn't have to pay insane prices for bags that were just like the real ones?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I found was that this journey was completely accidental on my end. Like it was just so easy to come across these things due to the preponderance of social media. So anonymous Reddit forums, there are some anonymous purse forums as well. And if you just Google like a particular bag, there will be like 10 different links that come up about obsessive forums just for that particular bag, where people are talking about the different colors, different models, like traveling across the world to get limited editions of those bags and things like that. So it follows that there is that same sort of obsessive culture around the super fake versions of that. And these people are buying things, from pretty like average sales channels like Instagram or like an eBay type platform, DHgate, AliExpress, that kind of thing.
So it's occurred to me as a woman that, we become aware from a young age at how our appearance shapes the way people treat us. And that extends, I think, to maybe the bag we carry or the shoes we have on. Has that been something that you've experienced in your life?
It absolutely has been. And I think that women are maybe more conscious of it, but even men feel that, especially now in the era of, men looking cooler than ever and paying more attention to their grooming and style. I think that it's such an interesting, like, thing to think about in terms of class. A handbag is a class signifier, right? In the way that like shoes are often a class signifier, but even more overtly so when you have like a logo that's on your arm and people can look at it and sort of pinpoint your salary band, and maybe how you grew up and what you value. And there's always been something that's really uncomfortable to me about that, as somebody who could not, move across class bands at will. Like an extremely rich person might be able to sort of like intentionally disguise themselves by quote unquote dressing down or dressing more casually. But a poor person doesn't easily access realms of wealth by suddenly looking a tremendous amount better, right? So it's a one directional sort of approach.
I was interested to read. You discovered there are people out there who can absolutely afford to pay for the genuine article, who still want a deal and still pursue the fakes.
There are, yeah, there's a tremendous number of people who are like well equipped and sort of have the means to buy as many Birkin bags as they want to. But rich people, the richer they get, they still love a great deal. So there are a lot of rich people out there who actually have encountered super fakes and been like, wait a minute, I can have the best of both worlds. I can have like the sort of hallmarks of my class and show other people how wealthy I am the way I want to, but also can save a little money for like the private jet or the next trip to the Hamptons or whatever else.
So most people listening will have encountered bad knockoffs at flea markets and, kiosks on the street in big cities. What is different? What distinguishes a super fake from a not so great knockoff?
Well, the Canal Street sort of like Las Vegas plasticky fake bag always has sort of a look of fakeness that most people can detect, and it's usually something like a totally wrong like color of gold that makes it clear it's plastic, or the shape is all weird, or like the stitching is like really, really like wonky and uneven or something like that. So a super fake bag, imagine it's just something that it has a much higher level of craftsmanship to it. Imagine that somebody has taken apart perhaps a real bag, studied it, and just reassembled it. And when you think about it that way, it becomes obvious that there's not actually like a big trick to manufacturing an extremely realistic counterfeit bag. It's just a matter of paying attention and having a lot of skilled craftsmanship to it. Like you couldn't do this with like a passenger plane, for instance, or something that's extremely complicated, but a handbag that's just a few strips of leather and a buckle, and some stitching in a particular pattern can easily be aped or duplicated or replicated.
After I read your story, I spent a few minutes reading the comments about it, and one that stuck with me was something like, which is the real crime, right? Duplicating designer goods and undercutting the real designer's business, or those luxury designers putting price tags on bags that might represent something like a 2,000% profit margin.
I was really sort of tickled by that as well. There was a sort of a rousing debate in the 2,000 or so comments on the piece, where half the people were sort of saying that they felt like the luxury manufacturers like LVMH and Chanel and those were the ones perpetrating the scam, and the others were insisting the counterfeiters were the ones being the scammers. So you can sort of like see the two sides very starkly divided, almost epitomize two different attitudes of human beings in the world, right? Like it's sort of a question of like, who is the one that is really being unethical at the end of the day? Is it the billionaire pocketing all of this from duplicated patterns, or is it the people who are either smart enough or evil enough or devious enough, whatever you want to call it, to have figured out this pattern and replicated it for themselves?
You learned that these very well-made fakes seem to be produced mostly in China, which is not that surprising given that a lot of the real stuff is made in Chinese factories today as well, right?
Yeah, so I myself am from China, so I sort of witnessed firsthand the proliferation of like the counterfeit market in China. And there it's not so much, it doesn't feel like an illicit like activity so much as just like a normal fact of life. Like, oh, you go and buy a toothbrush, you go and buy like a $5 knockoff, and it's sort of like funny and part of a wider like manufacturing culture. And there are so many people involved in the business itself, in the industry, that it just becomes like a normal matter of fact industry like anything else. So when you take that into account, like the fact that the labor market is so big in China for making counterfeits, and then match it to the demand from other parts of the world, perhaps it totally makes sense that all of us would be coming from China, like in tandem with like the real factories that are producing the real thing. And you just have so many people who are so skilled in leather making and craftsmanship in the first place, all together in one place.
Amy, how did it happen that Guangzhou specifically evolved into a kind of global epicenter of super fake production?
Well, Guangzhou is well situated geographically. It's if you look at a map of China, it's sort of like southeastern, down by close to Hong Kong, and sort of has this nice like coastal positioning. So for one thing, it makes a lot of sense that it's sort of like a big shipping hub. And then when you sort of add in legitimate factories and legitimate manufacturing into the scene, it has just swelled and swelled and swelled as the city has itself has grown and as China's population itself has industrialized and become a major manufacturing center. Guangzhou happened to be one of the hugest like bursts of activity there, so that's why you have all the counterfeit activity also coming from the same place, or the bulk of it rather, because the apparatuses are already set up there.
But tracking the bags to their absolute source turned out to be a real challenge, right? It's like different players in the supply chain get their information on a strictly need-to-know basis.
Yeah, that was a really interesting part of reporting the story. I had figured that a factory would have its own like hierarchy of, you know, sophisticated organization, as any sort of company that's legitimate or an illegitimate like crime sort of operation might, with like a boss at the top, and then you have managers and employees down the line. And perhaps that's how it used to be as a counterfeiting sort of landscape. But all of the intellectual property lawyers that I spoke with for the piece mentioned that it's actually quite different now. It's, as you mentioned, it's like a series of sort of need to know groups that all operate distinct of one another. And the reason for that is so that if you, as an authority, if you come in and bust one block or one group, then it can quickly replicate and it doesn't actually harm the other blocks. So, for instance, the sellers who communicate with US buyers, they speak English and they communicate fluidly over text or WeChat or Instagram. They're the sellers, but they don't actually know where the factories are, and the factories won't reveal, you know, their locations and their names and their bosses' names. And then you have an entirely other component of people who are sourcing the leathers and actually creating the designs and sort of the templates that the factory workers are working off of. So it's all very sophisticated in its organization, which makes it harder and harder to unravel for authorities, to the point where it's often just not worth it. It's like it's not worth busting one factory if you still have the same sellers out there, you have the same designers out there, and they're completely unaffected by this sort of like piecemeal attack.
You mentioned that there might be some reverse engineering going on to make these things perfectly resemble the real, genuine article. What else did you learn about how the people producing superfakes are able to make goods that are effectively identical to the real ones that might be sold in a boutique somewhere for thousands of dollars?
So two parts to the extreme quality of super fake counterfeit bags. One is the technology itself has really leveled up. So when we say technology, we mean like a machine that it very specifically is meant to heat stamp a particular logo into leather in a particular way, or like a machine that makes, what are those called? The RFID cards that can sort of give you like a unique barcode, authentication cards, those rectangle cards that sometimes come with bags or expensive jewelry that sort of say like, this is a genuine item from Cartier or whatever it is. Those have also been faked to a really high degree now because the technology simply exists. So people can buy these machines to make them. And the second part to the quality is the quality of the raw materials. So counterfeiters have realized that they can go to the same artisan leather market in Italy or France or wherever else that the real companies are also buying from. So they buy the exact same swaths of leather, perhaps tanned the exact same way, in the exact same color, and then buy the same buckles. And once you have all of those dimensions one-to-one-to-one, assembling it is just a matter of looking at something and making sure that you're creating and replicating the same design in it.
So I want to stipulate that I do think intellectual property is important and people have the rights to protect their copyrights. On the other hand, your article also made me think about the almost magical properties that we assign to something that has been produced by a designer house somewhere. When a leather bag is essentially a leather bag, especially if all the materials are the same.
That's exactly what preoccupied me as well. Like it is illegal to we should put that out there, that it's illegal to counterfeit items and to steal someone's design. But then there's this whole other argument that if the design itself is owned and patented by a huge conglomerate that is raking in billions and billions of dollars that are not going, you know, to the employees making the bags, to the factory workers, to the people sweeping the shards of whatever assembly materials that actually are happening on the factory floor. If that is the case, then is it still really unethical or immoral or all of that to sort of steal a design and replicate it in a factory that is doing the exact same thing as a legitimate factory? It's an interesting legal, I mean, it's the legal question is actually very clear, but it's an interesting ethical question.
Were you able to learn anything at all about working conditions for people who work in, say, a Celine factory located in China and one of these super fake houses in Guangzhou?
You know, there are a lot of conflicting reports about this. Some people say that, like, conditions in counterfeit factories in China or anywhere else are really abysmal, and that it's sort of like a poor, like, almost sweatshop-like quality of life to be stuck in these factories all day. But other people also allege that that is just sort of almost xenophobic or possibly like sort of like racist casting of the situation. Just because we don't know anything about what the factories look like, we shouldn't automatically assume that they're run by poorly treated workers in sort of like unpleasant situations. So that is to say, we don't know anything about how counterfeit factories actually work. There's not been verified footage out of them, or photography, or journalists have never been allowed in either to see these things. So what we're hearing is really like secondhand and third hand from people who allege to have seen these things. And we don't have anything definitive to say, unfortunately, which adds to the sort of ethical murkiness of it all.
The xenophobia thing is really interesting here because, you know, there are Americans who will talk about goods made in China and say they're cheap quality and they're poorly fabricated. That's demonstrably not true, right? So much of what we buy in this country now, sourced from companies that may be based in the United States but manufacture in China, we consider them quality goods. It is not true that things that come out of China are not made as well as things that are produced elsewhere.
Right, that's right, and that adds an interesting dimension into the question of like how a super fake is so good, right? Like I think maybe from 20 or 30 years ago, people had this loose impression that like if a good is made in China, then it's going to be shoddier. But like if you think about how, you know, like Apple iPhone parts are made in China and all these other things that are considered top of the line are made in China, then it does start to make sense that like a super fake handbag made from China would be like top-notch quality, because there are people with the sophistication, with the technology, with the craftsmanship and training to actually produce that.
Did it feel like some cloak and dagger transaction? Because I have to tell you, like, based on your description of it, it sounds more like chatting with a seller on Etsy about like wanting a skirt hemmed to a certain length or something. It sounds very quotidian.
That was exactly my experience. It was like having a text conversation with like an Uber driver trying to decide where you are on the street, or a sales rep on Amazon or whatever else. And it made me realize that the experience of buying online has become so normalized and we're so conditioned to it, right, that we don't feel a particular sort of unease about buying a handbag online, because everything we buy is done the exact same way, like chatting back and forth, dealing with customer service over text message, making purchases and making transactions fully over the phone without needing to see the bag or the item from many angles, without needing to go out and touch it and feel the fabric of it. Perhaps even just looking at a single image, sometimes we just say, that seems like something I'd like, and click buy. And it's so sort of second nature to us now to just buy from images.
So you and the seller agreed on this purchase price of $132 for a bag that would be functionally identical to the real designer bag that cost about $2,200. Did you worry at all about being swindled out of your $132?
Absolutely, I did. I for the whole time I was like, this is definitely off in many ways, right? Like it's an illegal purchase that you're making over the phone with someone whose face you don't even know, whose name you don't even know, because they give you aliases typically that are so clearly not their real name. So the whole time I was like, well, like I'll probably lose $100 for this bag and it'll never arrive. And honestly, that's not the worst thing that would happen in the world. With the price of everything nowadays, like we look at a dinner for two or like an average pair of shoes or whatever, and it's like easily $100 out the window. So $100 for this counterfeit bag that may or may not arrive, that's pledged to be every bit as good as the original, felt like a good enough risk that I took it, and it did arrive.
And then, how did you feel opening it up?
I felt sort of not let down really, but sort of apathetic about it really. Like I opened it and I was like, oh, there it is. There's a bag. I don't really know what I had expected that would make it extra magical, but that dimension of it never really appeared when I was actually taking it out of the bag. What did happen was when I took it around places, I noticed that it sort of changed how I felt about myself or how I felt I was being perceived, particularly in rooms or in scenes, in landscapes where people around me were really wealthy. I felt like I was a changed person or had fit in a different way, and it contributed to my sort of psychological understanding of myself in a new way. But the bag itself, when looking at it, not attached to me as a person, it's just an average bag. It's an object the way that like a can of Diet Coke is an object or a computer is an object.
Were you able to tease out your motivation for wanting it? I mean, was it the quality of the object and the look of it, or was it the status that it might represent for you?
It was absolutely the status of it. From a quality perspective, very few luxury bags are actually all that special. Many of them are made with sort of quotidian, like everyday leathers, everyday buckles. Like many objects are not even completely solid gold when you look at the buckles or the clasps or the zippers. So all of that is to say that the ingredients to the bag, to a luxury handbag, are fairly average, and the assembly is average to sometimes very good. But the bag itself represents so much more than what it is. Like it's not just a burlap sack, right? Like any woman who's purchased a bag or looked at like a Chanel bag with the iconic double C's or the quilting has sort of like felt something about it, that it goes beyond what it is right in front of you, and it has to do with its cultural perception of it, the way that you've seen the bag in advertisements, the way you may have seen them on the arms of celebrities or in really glamorous movies or on red carpets, or sort of dangling from the arms of socialites and extremely rich people who walk around the world, accompanied by this cute little thing that makes you feel like you want to enter that world and you want to be a part of something that is bigger than yourself. And the bag is a sort of hallucinogenic entry point into that.
It's also remarkable to me that there are certain wealth indicators, status symbols that we approve of in this culture, and there are others that we disapprove of. And I think about, lots of people love art, only some people have the resources to own a lot of original art. But it's unquestionably a sign that you are quite wealthy if you take guests through your home and sort of point things out. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is, that's a wealth display. We just don't think about it that way.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And it's a display of wealth to fly, first class as opposed to commercial. And we don't frown upon people in first class. We kind of like envy them and like as we're toting our suitcases past their bigger aisles and their huge seats and their free drinks, we're kind of like, oh, like I wish I could be that person. But on the other hand, we frown upon people who fly their private jets too many times. It's a funny like little gray dotted line between how much wealth we're able to tolerate and envy and how much we turn our noses up against.
What did you learn about the work that the US government does trying to keep fake designer goods out of US markets?
I was really surprised at first by learning that US Customs is only to able to inspect and delay and sometimes apprehend a very, very small percentage of counterfeit items. But then I learned that there's so much that floods in into the country, into borders every day, that there's simply not the manpower, the capacity, or resources to actually manually inspect a lot of things. And then once you add super fakes into the equation and you don't know if a bag is a real Birkin bag that someone's friend may have been sending from China, or a fake Birkin bag someone bought from China, then it's like, how do you expect customs authorities to be able to tell what's real and what's not, what's illicit and what isn't, out of the equation? So what I learned is that, in short, like there is a tremendous amount of counterfeit material coming into the US, coming into other countries as well on a daily basis. And it's no one's, it's not the fault of any authority that is meant to stop it because they simply don't have the forces or the extremely well-trained craftsmanship eye to pick that out.
So nobody should, pay a lot of money for something that isn't real when they think they're getting the genuine object. But I wonder, are these policies, the customs inspections, is the idea that they're protecting American consumers, or are they working mostly in service to design houses?
That is a good point too. I mean, there are a lot of like luxury houses that have trade groups in DC and lobby for strict anti-counterfeiting laws, and they do sometimes succeed. Like a few years ago, actually, the law changed in the US such that any counterfeit good that came into the US is now required to be destroyed. So a customs official who finds like a fake Burberry bag and can confidently identify it as a fake Burberry bag is ordered to destroy it. Like you can't donate it, you can't keep it for yourself and take it home for your daughter or whatever else. Like that mandate of destruction of counterfeit goods was something that came about because luxury houses asked for it and sort of pleaded their case and lobbied for it for many years. So a lot of the law in the US and in the world, actually, around luxury goods and around intellectual property does cater to the needs and the sort of like big voices and big pockets of the large companies that have clearly an interest in protecting their work.
Theoretically, I don't know what you earn, but I can guess you could have saved up for a few months and decided you wanted the real thing. But it's almost like virtue signaling to let your friends know, no, this was an amazing bargain, not what you think.
It totally is virtue signaling. And when you think about it, like there are many other bags that also do a version of virtue signaling, like the Telfar bags that are those like big sort of rectangular bags with a T on them that signal not just the bag itself, but like a minority supporting person of color, like business that does really cool, innovative stuff. The New Yorker tote bag is also a virtue signal. When you bring it to the store, you're like, I'm a member of the intellectual elite, right? Like you're not, you don't really need that tote bag over the other tote bags in the world, but you kind of also do, because if you're signaling that particular thing, it's incredibly effective. So the bags in general, like the big signifier of who you are, apparently.
Have you thought about how different it might feel if you bought a real bag?
How different from buying a super fake? I have, and to follow this like thread down the entire down to its end, I actually did buy one real bag. However, it's from a resale marketplace, like a consignor resale site. So I bought it so I could compare if it was better or worse or felt different than the real thing, only to realize that I didn't actually know if it was still genuine or not. Like it still could be a fake because I bought it from a resale site that could have not authenticated it properly. So the question still is up in the air of whether real bags have a different like aura or some sort of power that is intangible to them.
Did the newspaper get any response, the magazine, from actual design houses? I mean, often they take great umbrage at the idea that anybody would create a fake good and undercut their price without necessarily justifying why they charge quite so much. I mean, I guess that's part of the mystique, right? That they charge 20 times what something is actually worth.
I think the umbrage comes from all angles, depending on what wealth class you're in. If you yourself have actually spent $10,000 on a Chanel bag, then you might be outraged that you can now buy a super fake version for $100. And if you never were able to afford the $10,000 version, then you might be outraged that it exists in the first place. So everybody's gotten mad in a really entertaining, funny kind of refraction of what the article itself is saying, that money doesn't make sense, and luxury goods is a really hallucinatory thing to think about.
Are you done with this phase of your life, or would you consider, if a gorgeous new design comes out in 2 years, would you consider buying another super fake?
That's TBD. I think I've reached a comfortable level of like self-reflection when I look at Chanel bags and Birkin bags and these sorts of like cult status symbols, that I can no longer want them, which I feel like is some sort of huge achievement. Like I can look at a bag and not covet it and just be like, that exists out in the world, and it's not, a lifestyle ambition anymore or an aspiration.
Amy X. Wang is assistant managing editor of the New York Times Magazine, which published her article Inside the Delirious Rise of Superfake Handbags. Amy, thank you so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you so much, Grace. This is wonderful.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.